Support for this podcast comes from Greenhouse. Greenhouse is your all-together hiring platform. Engage top talent with smart sourcing tools. Deliver a more equitable interviewing process. Welcome new hires with ease. And get the insights you need to make measurable improvements. All within a single platform. Hire better, all together, with Greenhouse.
There's been more of scientific discovery, more of technical advancement and material progress in your lifetime and mine than in all the ages of history.
Hi there. Welcome to episode 610 of Recruiting Future with me, Matt Alder. It's becoming evident that we are at a critical pivot point for talent acquisition. While the debates around AI are sucking up most of the attention, massive shifts are happening in terms of the shelf life of skills, ongoing challenges with skills acquisition, and upskilling people for a very different future world of work. So, how should employers think about skills? And how can talent acquisition gain the future focus it needs to drive organisational value? My guest this week is Lisa Monteith, Head of Talent Acquisition and Onboarding for HSBC in the UK. In our wide-ranging conversation, we talk about the skills challenges facing organisations and the importance of taking a long-term view. Hi, Lisa, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Matt. How are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you. And it is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show. Please, could you introduce yourself and tell us what you do?
Absolutely. So my name is Lisa Monteith. I am the Head of Talent Acquisition and Onboarding for HSBC in the UK. I'm responsible for hires that would anyone outside of our grad apprenticeship or our exec level. So responsible for a direct team of 11. And we work with an RPO for our permanent hiring and an MSP for our contract hiring. And my team on the perm side are responsible of anywhere between 4,500 to 6,000 hires a year across retail banking, investment banking, corporate services, commercial banking, so on and so forth.
Tell us about some of the challenges you're finding in those markets with talent acquisition at the moment.
I think like most organisations, as we sort of shift towards a skills-based economy, finding those real sort of more technical skills and also that ability, those communication skills, analytical skills, problem-solving skills are quite challenging because they're very highly prized and a lot of people are looking out for them. And I also think some of the challenges that we face is it's more of a sort of a commercial approach now, or not transactional, but it's, if you think about when you purchase a product or a service, you buy it because you want it, it fits with your lifestyle and so on and so forth. But really, the world of work is becoming much more like that. Are we selling roles that people want to do? Does it fit with the other aspects of their life that they want to kind of manage in the round? You know, in terms of how much time we want people in the office, how much time people want to work at home. So there's a lot of moving parts currently that throw up challenges within talent acquisition. And I think part and parcel of that lends itself to skill acquisition, skills growth, future skills, changing skills, all of that type of stuff.
And I suppose digging a bit deeper into the skills conversation, as it were, one of the obvious challenges is that you're recruiting people for specific skills. As you said, in some markets, that's very, very difficult in terms of people have a choice and you need to obviously kind of persuade them to join you rather than your competition. But we also live in a world where the lifespan of skills is getting very, very short. I mean, is that something that you're seeing in the recruiting that you're doing, that you're recruiting people with skills and those skills are going out of date very quickly?
I think one of the great things about HSBC is that we have a huge commitment around sort of skills growth, skills development, future skills, and providing sort of easy access to learning to help build that capability and skill. And I think like most organisations and like I think the OECD has just come out with a report and the World Economic Forum around the fact that the priority has to be about skills growth, about reskilling our workforce, because we're just simply not developing the skills fast enough, or those skills don't exist in the external marketplace. And so for us, I think there's that real challenge between what are you trying to buy in? And it's that sort of total workforce strategy or total talent strategy where, you know, the old classic, do you buy it? Do you borrow it? Do you build it? Do you bot it? That type of stuff. And those are all the things that we're really having to, I think, organisationally, we're all having to grapple with, because it is about reskilling. A big part of what we do now is focused on reskilling.
And does that impact talent acquisition in terms of, are you looking for people who are good at that or open to that or are kind of really into lifelong learning? Is that a skill, if you like, that you look for?
I think we're going to see more and more of that. That whole, you know, how do you recruit for potential? And the traditional methodologies we've used around selection and assessment, does that lend itself to us identifying that potential, that learning agility, that real sort of curious mindset? So those are very, very different things. And that individuals won't necessarily know that they recognise that in themselves. And they have that propensity to acquire what might be very, very different skills to the ones they thought they were entering the workforce with. And I think that is going to be one of our big challenges. One of the great stories I always tell was a friend of a friend who was an English graduate went to work for one of the biggest tech companies as a general management trainee, and they put them through an assessment for potential development centre and became their biggest big ticket item salesperson, and they had no idea that they had that capability. So I think there's some, we have to find ways of being able to tease out people's confidence to learn new skills as well. And I think like that's one of the biggest challenges.
You mentioned, you know, curiosity, learning agility, all those kind of things. When you talk about future skills, those kind of sort of long-term things that are going to sort of pull people through this, I mean, tell us a little bit more about what you think they are or what you're seeing at the moment.
I mean, I think the big fear factor at the moment is around AI, isn't it? And machine learning. And is that going to take all our jobs away? And are we going to be run by technology? And I think for me, some of the biggest areas that we need to consider are things about how do we, that analytical capability, how do we embrace that sort of that digital resilience at speed, or that, you know, all of the, everything's moving at such a pace. And so it's about that ability, that analytical capability. It's about that communication capability. It's about problem solving. It's about building relationships, telling the story of, if we've got machine learning and we've got AI doing all this work for us, you know, where's the human intervention part of that, and how do we bring that to life and bring that in a meaningful way? So I think those communication skills, that analytical capability, and our ability to sort of, you know, build relationships between those data points and with each other is absolutely critical.
I suppose if we look at this over the long term, so if we sort of fast forward 10 years and think about what work might be like then, although it's difficult to fast forward 10 months at the moment and think about what it's going to be like. But in 10 years time, everyone who's going to be at work in 10 years time is either already has a job or is currently in the education system. Where do you think the gaps are in terms of preparing people for either their next job or people in the education system for entering a very different world of work?
So I think we have to really think about what we do next and those people those individuals that are already in education. So if I think about my own children that came out of education in the last couple of years, came out of university, they've got degrees that suggest are probably meaningless to the roles that they're currently doing. So therefore, was there any use in them going to university? And I think that we have to, you know, if we think about how we educate our young people, we still educate our young people in the way that we were educated, the way our parents were educated. Well, is that setting them up for success in this new world of work that they're going to be entering, which is going to bear no resemblance to the world of work you and I started in many years ago? And if you think about the types of roles they might come into. So when I was at school, you know, a lot of my contemporaries went into a bank. So they went into a local bank for one of the big banking firms. They started as a cashier and then they worked their way up through the bank. The same, you know, if you went into work in a supermarket. Well, now, how many people do you see sitting on a till in a supermarket? Very few, because it's all self-service, or you order online, or, you know, so it's delivery drivers. They're very, very different roles now and very different opportunities. And so therefore, you know, is university the right route? Is it going to give you what you need? Is it going to build your skill and capability and make you right for the workforce? Is our secondary education actually providing us with what we need in order to thrive when we go into the world of work? Is it setting us up for success? And are the roles there that we would traditionally have gone into? These are all things that we need to grapple with. These are all things that we need to think about. Because I don't think any of that's right. And unless we're thinking, you know, I know there's new T skills, but there's a big reliance on organisations to be able to provide the training foundation for that. And I just think that, you know, apprenticeships or degree apprenticeships, those sorts of things, are maybe the thing of the future, but very different to the ones that we might have traditionally done.
We'll get back to the show in just a moment, but I wanted to take a minute or so to talk about something that I know is critical for you all right now. Talent acquisition is going through an unprecedented transformation, and many of you are likely in the middle of planning your strategies as we move through 2024 towards 2025. We all know that operating models, change management, and aligning TA with corporate objectives are essential parts of any transformation strategy. But with the market and AI technologies in particular evolving so rapidly, there's a real risk that your strategy could quickly become outdated. That's where strategic foresight comes in. It's a proven methodology that helps you build credible future scenarios, create agile strategies, and most importantly, have a proactive influence on what the future of talent acquisition looks like, both within your organisation and across the industry. I know you're busy, so I've created a concise online course that breaks down strategic foresight into easy-to-learn tools specifically designed for TA transformation. It's quick to implement and will keep you ahead of the curve. You can learn more by visiting mattalder.me/course. That's mattalder.me/course. There's really never been a better time to shape the future of talent acquisition. So don't miss this opportunity to make a lasting impact. Yeah, I mean, I'm interested from, I suppose, a corporate perspective. It's like, you know, what can you do as a company to kind of really support that sort of thing? Because 10 years is going to come around pretty quickly. And as we suggested, the world that we're describing of being the world of 10 years time could be the world of next year. So where does the kind of responsibility for corporations lie in terms of having that sort of, you know, that pipeline or that conveyor belt of, you know, talent coming through?
I read a really scary fact today on a piece of research that in the next 10 years, and this was from 2020, and so by 2030, 90% of the UK workforce would need to be retrained because there would be very, very different roles. Now, I think it's incumbent on organisations to be able to provide availability to skills growth, skills development, new acquisition of skill. But I actually think we all as individuals have to take responsibility for that too. If we want to remain relevant, if we want to continue to sort of drive our careers in the way that we want them to, then I think we have to drive our own learning for ourselves. And I think traditionally we've waited, there's this culture of, you know, I am going to wait till I'm put on a training course, or I am going to apply to go on a training course, and that would be an in-person training course, and it will be for X number of days, and I will learn this when I'm there. Whereas I think now is very much part and parcel of, you know, bite-sized chunks. There's bite-sized pieces of learning. There's bits of research. There's bits of, you know, if you think about LinkedIn and the various different modules you can pick up there, we have a degree platform at HSBC. So you can do bite-sized pieces of learning in a number of different ways to build your skill in the time that you've got available. And so I think that, you know, there is still an argument for that in-person training. There's still an argument for all of those different things. But I think, as individuals, we have to take charge of our own destiny, because if we wait for organisations to convey that upon us, then I think we're going to be a long time waiting. I'm not talking about HSBC, I'm just talking generically in organisations. I think if we want to remain relevant, we have to take charge of our own learning.
Yeah, and I think that you kind of really sort of identify the flip side of all of this is like, yeah, skills are going out of date really quickly, but we've never been in a better position as individuals to learn new skills. You've got the access to all the world's knowledge on your phone. So, you know, I think that's a big part of this as well.
Very much so. Very much so. I think, you know, I just think that, you know, it's very difficult, isn't it? Because it's like we're all so very busy. There's, you know, we're doing more with less in the workplace, but we have to find those nuggets of time. And we're all multi-screen, aren't we? So you're learning something, reading something while you're watching something. So those are the things that to continue to build that capability and skill within ourselves and organisations to make it available.
One of the other things I wanted to talk about is as things have developed and we understand more about the brain, I think the world is finally coming to terms with the fact that a huge proportion of the global population is neurodiverse and doesn't think the same way as everyone else. And, you know, that might be people with who've been officially diagnosed with specific things or just kind of, you know, everyone's brain in general being a bit different. Earlier on, you were talking about, you know, assessment and having to assess people for potential and learning agility and those kind of things. And obviously there's been a big move in the last sort of couple of years towards, you know, some great kind of assessment tools out there that can do these kind of things through technology. Do you think that there are issues or disadvantages for neurodivergent people when it comes to those kind of current ways that we do, I suppose the traditional ways we've done assessment, but also some of the newer ways that we're doing assessment?
Yeah, I mean, and I say this as a parent of two neurodiverse young people. I think that historically we look at assessment tools and say, well, there's no adverse impact for people with disability, but that's absolutely predicated on homogenization of that disability. And actually, if you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, and the needs of those individuals are so very, very diverse. And I think that, you know, we try and standardize a lot of selection methodology. We do have reasonable adjustments. We've got disability confidence schemes, and most organisations do. But I think there's a balance to be had, because I think, as you know, one in five people are thought to be neurodiverse, and that can look and feel very, very different depending on that individual. And I think that the assessment techniques that we use, I think there's a challenge with some of those, and how can we diversify them and make them accessible whilst also having a barometer for what we're, you know, a consistency around what we're checking and what we're assessing for. I think that there's a perception issue, both in terms of individuals. Should I declare, is that going to be a bad thing if I tell people I'm neurodiverse? And so that I think the pressure on some neurodiverse individuals for masking and sort of and mirroring is exhausting for them, and so that, you know, that can have real sort of implications around stress and anxiety. So I think that's problematic. And I also think from our knowledge and understanding as recruiters and as hiring managers, we don't fully understand what equity looks like more broadly. And so therefore, when you start talking about reasonable adjustments, when you start talking about leveling the playing field, that might be that somebody has the questions ahead of schedule. It might be that you have to make sure you've got text. If it's a Zoom interview, you've got text, or you give the written questions during the interview, or you give more time, or you allow time between the questions. There's all these different things that you can do to try and improve from an interview standpoint. But I think some of the psychometric tools that we might use more broadly, Let's step away from this homogenized notion of no adverse impact for disabled people, because there's a nuance around language and syntax and all that kind of stuff and decoding that can have a material impact.
Yeah, and I also think that there's a lot of stereotyping in terms of how people will be and how people present themselves at work. So, for example, all autistic people are going to be amazing at maths and statistics. Everyone with ADHD has got this incredible hyper-focus superpower that's going to, you know, power them through. And I think there is kind of a lot of stereotypical thinking, which also puts pressure on people as well to, again, behave in a certain way.
I mean, I always tell this story. I've got three children. And I've got one who is neurotypical and two that are neurodiverse. So if you were to give all three of them the questions before an interview, that the neurotypical one is so focused, they would have the questions, they would have an answer down pat, and they would probably max score it. My second child would be able to do that, would be able to answer the questions, but would be so anxious and worried that they were going to get it wrong, and that would cause them immense kind of anxiety. And the third one would still be trying to decode the question, because she wouldn't be able to. That third child is doing biochemistry at uni. And it's those assumptions and those perceptions and that bias. So my third child is ADHD. She's dyspraxic, dyslexic, ADHD, but she's on a tennis scholarship in the States, doing biochemistry. So this superpower thing is just a myth and a misnomer. It's simply, you know, it's people think and do differently. And that's the bit that we need to embrace. And it's a bit like, you know, I wear glasses. That's just the norm. People accept me with wearing glasses. But actually, I've got a different prescription to maybe you, Matt. But without our glasses, we can't do what we do.
I think that's very true. And at the end of the day, you know, everyone's brain's different. I think that's kind of the message from all of this. Just to sort of tie everything together, because we've covered a huge amount of topics in quite a short period of time. Obviously, some of the things that you've kind of struck me talking about future skills, also that kind of total talent approach, work as a product, plus things we've been talking about in terms of education and neurodiversity. Lots of change ahead in the world of talent acquisition. What do you think talent acquisition might look like in a few years' time as these things take hold and companies have strategies to deal with some of these issues?
I mean, I think part of the challenge that for talent acquisition in itself is we're going to have to continue to reinvent ourselves. So if we think about the use of AI in sort of, you know, inferred skills about being able to kind of find people with particular skills or inferred skills from their CVs and stuff like that, I think that we have to have some responsibility for helping individuals be able to navigate those skills as well, so that our ability to communicate has to improve. I think that even if we have AI sort of pulling together sort of recommendations for shortlists or skill people with specific skills, I think that human intervention value piece is going to be the bit that makes the difference. And so we're going to have to up our game. I think lots of people, you see people talking about it on LinkedIn about being ghosted by recruiters. You know, we're sort of the copper's children, aren't we? We're not very good at recruiting our own people, or treating a sort of our talent acquisition colleagues in the best possible way. And I think we're going to have to get better at doing that. And the value proposition that we offer, and where we can determine that value piece, is going to be how we bring that skills agenda that comes out of AI to life for our businesses, and how and our view of what that future, always being able to anticipate the future around the business plan and what that's going to mean in terms of skills, where that skill is within in a given geography or in the globe, depending on how we're looking to recruit for. And I think we're just going to have to be far more, futurist, I think, was the term I heard quite a lot at LinkedIn conference, a lot of futurists about. But as a talent acquisition team, I think we're going to have to start being much more future focused.
Lisa, thank you very much for talking to me.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's been a joy.
My thanks to Lisa. You can follow this podcast on Apple Podcasts, on Spotify, or via your podcasting app of choice. Please also subscribe to our YouTube channel by going to mattalder.tv. You can search all the past episodes at recruitingfuture.com. On that site, you can also subscribe to our monthly newsletter, Recruiting Future Feast, and get the inside track about everything that's coming up on the show. Thanks very much for listening. I'll be back next time, and I hope you'll join me.
This is my show.